Hey, dear listener, do you enjoy listening to us ramble incoherently about Canadian politics and history? Boy, do we have a special fucking treat for you. We've got our first ever official live show at a bar.
It's at Two Crows Brewing on Brunswick Street in Halifax on Sunday, May the 26th at 8 p.m. And if you go to CanadianPoliticsIsBoring.com, if you look at the banner at the top, it will take you to the tickets so that you can book a ticket and come and spend some quality time. It is going to be a very intimate affair. There are like only about 50 tickets available.
It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to drink a lot. We're going to quiz. Reese is going to quiz me at the end, but he's also going to quiz the audience and see if they know more than I do. And any alcohol you buy, Reese and I, we promise to drink it, no matter how much it is. If you want to hold our hair while we barf in the plants outside of the bar, we'll do that for you.
So go to CanadianPoliticsIsBoring.com, click the banner at the top, and on Sunday, May the 26th at Two Crows Brewing on Brunswick Street, we will see you there.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Canadian Politics is Boring!
Welcome to another terribly exciting episode of Canadian Politics is Boring. Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for sticking us in your ear holes just the way you like it. My name is Jesse. With me, as always, is Reese. Say hello, Reese.
Hello!
And today we've got a very special guest, Greg from the YouTube, very, very popular YouTube show, How to Drink, one of my favorite channels. Greg, all the way from New Jersey. If you want people, we can delete that if you don't want people to know where you are.
No, it's fine. They can know where I'm from. I'm proud of it.
It's a big place.
Thank you for that introduction. I am proud to be from New Jersey. We lead the country in Superfund sites. That's toxic waste dumps for those of you who are outside of the U.S. You
may
know that term.
What is it called?
We call them Superfund sites because back in the 70s, they created a Superfund to pay for cleaning them all up.
Nice. And,
but it's a misnomer. People from around the U.S. like to claim, oh, New Jersey's got the most. Like, yeah, because we didn't lie about it. We went after the money.
So when I heard you say super, like, so it's super fun with a D, but I heard you say super fun.
They like, are super
I thought, fun. I thought you super said fun. Super fun.
Yeah. Yeah, you can go there, roll around, get special powers and stuff. It's great.
You so, just find an animal you want the powers of, hold it close to your chest and roll on the floor.
Yeah. Yeah. DuPont is not liable for the after effects.
before we dive into today's mystery episode with Reese, Greg, do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about your show?
Certainly. Thank you so much for the intro, man. That was a very generous intro. You said that it's hugely popular. I'm not I take your word for it. I take your word for it. It's YouTube is, you know, you swim with whales.
That's but, true.
No, thank you so much. I have this show called How to Drink, where I've been making cocktails on YouTube for about 5 years now. A lot of stuff from pop culture and video games and movies, and also just a lot of baseline classics, a lot of history from mixology. You know, nothing better and more fun than having to give your bio on the spot. It's my favorite part of my life.
Elevator pitch.
Yes.
But yeah, You have a really cool set. Everything looks amazing and really classy on your site, and you're really engaging as well.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, I'll tell you the thing that I wanted it to be when I started it off, because I had a little bit of background in tabletop commercial production. I was like, well, what if we made it very, because there was some stuff online that was very pretty, but took itself very seriously. And then there was some stuff that didn't take itself very seriously, but they had no production values. And I was like, well, what if we made it very pretty, but didn't take it very seriously at all? And that was kind of the nexus point of.
I think it works.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's kind of how we do our show.
We're just two idiots with microphones. It's great. We talk about a topic that is inherently boring. So yours is the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. Reese, what do you got for us today?
Well, we're over the border in Canada. Greg, you're over the border in the USA. And since you're kind of an expert in alcohol and drinks, this episode is called King Canada and the Prohibition Startups, and it's all about the cross border trade of illicit alcohol during Prohibition.
Oh my God! Yes.
Yeah.
Do you know much about it?
I really feel like I frantically Google. I should know more than I do. Let me tell you what I know. I know that certainly a lot of illicit alcohol entered the U.S. from Canada. That Prohibition is credited with. I'm blowing up your show right now. We'll cut this out.
Don't find it on Wikipedia because I'm drawing from.
I was gonna say Prohibition is credited with the popularity of Canadian whiskey in the U.S. throughout much of the 20th century because it's where we were getting the whiskey from.
Oh, cool.
But I don't know how true that is. You know, with a lot of that, there's so much mythology. And mythologizing, which is a word that is tough for me to wrap my mouth around, around prohibition and mixology and cocktails in general, that it's tough sometimes to know what you don't know. Like one of the common myths I've always heard, or that you'll hear a lot, is that, well, cocktails, those were come from prohibition because we couldn't get good hooch. And so people had to mix them up to make them palatable. But that's absolutely not true. Like the the golden age of cocktails is the 1860s. That's when Jerry Thomas and his fellow luminaries were, the celebrities of their age. People would come from miles around. It was like when you went to New York, a stop at the Jerry Thomas bar, the Exchange, was like on the list. It was in the travel guide. You got to see this guy make drinks. And that's, that's what, 70 years, 60 years before. I can't add. as evidenced by my questions about the scheduling of this event.
Right. Yeah. I've got a question for you. Why are they called cocktails?
Yeah, that's the etymology there is hotly debated in the drier mixology circles. So one story I've heard is that it actually comes from possibly, I want to say Irish, or English. Yeah. And each of those groups of people are offended at me now for saying it could be one or the other, but an expression that had to do with selling horses. And this is going to get a little bit graphic. I know.
Graphic. That's all what our show is all about.
Yes. So
horrifying graphic.
One thing about a cocktail is that not all mixed drinks are cocktails. Like traditionally speaking, a cocktail is a combination of spirit, water, sweetness, sugar, and some kind of bitters. A bittering agent is really important there. They were considered medicinal tonics to have at breakfast to start your day up. Yes. Yeah.
That's what I always say. That's what I tell my kids.
Yeah.
You know,
and it was
supposed to your kids a lot.
and so they were eye openers. They were kind of corpse survivors. And so there is this theory that comes from an expression or practice of jamming some freshly shaved ginger up the ass of a horse you were selling to make it hold its tail up so it looked like a young, spry horse that wasn't on death's door to cock its tail. So there is some people who say that. I don't. I've also heard a lot of people say, no, there's no possibility that that's true.
I have to try that with my dog. He's a bit tired.
Yeah.
My God.
That is my favorite etymology, and also the only one that I can remember at the moment. So we're going to go with that one.
I think that's a good one. Let's go with that one. That's history now.
Yeah, I'm going to shove some ginger up my ass tomorrow morning, wake myself up. That's going to be
go for a jog.
Yeah, go for a jog.
guys, you might there are. There's a place. There are places where that is a common practice. No Super places I've ever been, but I have awareness. I'm just letting you know that you may be attracting an unusual fan base if you go down this route on your show.
Right. Well, that's yeah. Well. Maybe it'll come up. It won't. But anyway,
I don't know what I did in some episode of How to Drink, but I probably a solid 18% of How to Drink fans on Twitter, at least, are furries. I don't mind it. I don't know why they like my show so much. I don't know what I did. I'm not exaggerating at all.
Fundamentally, it must be hard to drink in one of those suits as well.
I asked about this, and they said, well, because we love drinking. ask a stupid question. I mean,
right, yeah. Exactly.
Furries. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Maybe 18% of all the population are furries anyway. Maybe it's just
shit.
It's just a perfect
cross section. Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
I had an older podcast. It didn't have a lot of listeners, but suddenly, out of nowhere, 80% of my listener base, an extra 200 people per month, came out of nowhere. And I looked at the statistics, like, oh, they're all from France for no reason whatsoever. I had like an extra 200 listeners in France out of nowhere for months.
The Jerry Lewis phenomenon.
Yeah, it was very strange. It was very strange.
That's really weird.
Reese, before we go off on incredible tangents as we tend to do, why don't you educate us? Me, Greg probably knows all about this, I'm sure.
So all right, in 1920, the 18th Amendment was passed by the United States Congress, where they kind of caved into all the temperance groups who believed that the banning of alcohol sales and distribution would stop people from spending all their money drinking, wasting their lives, and help them focus on the better things in life, like being sober, apparently. Right. So... this happened, and it became a federal offense to be involved in any kind of alcohol production or sales or anything at all. So Canada saw an amazing opportunity because they were still getting hammered. And it meant that when Prohibition came to the United States, Canadians had dollar signs in their eyes in like a cartoon style where they spun around. It became a real opportunity. So essentially, smugglers would like kind of load boats with booze, and they'd sneak across the Great Lakes, St. Lawrence River, under cover of darkness. And then, also other rum runners would travel to Boston from like eastern parts of Canada, or Seattle from western Canada. And a lot of the speakeasies and like secret bars that were springing up all over the USA were directly supplied by illicitly kind of smuggled Canadian booze.
Wow! So I like the thought, the imagery of them loading like a boat full of booze and going across the Great Lake in the cover of darkness. Like it's very stealthy. I don't know. There's some kind of Ocean's 11 aspect to that.
Oh, yeah.
Like 1800s Ocean's 11 style. No, this is 1900s.
I know there was a lot of movement across the Great Lakes. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there was in other places. I mean, we have a very large border. Sure there was plenty of crossing elsewhere and the other coasts. I specifically to the Great Lakes, and I have no citation for this. I just recall hearing or reading somewhere that some gangster, and I forget which, had set up kind of like an underwater, maybe it was at a river or something like that, like an underwater pulley system with like a carriage that they could, you know, pull the stuff under the water by rope. And in when it would freeze over, they just had like these two holes at each end, and like the booze would go in one hole and out the other hole.
You're referring to the Windsor Detroit Funnel.
There it is.
Which was an underwater delivery system using submerged cables and mechanical pulleys that could move 50-gallon drums of booze from Windsor, Ontario to Detroit.
I didn't realize it was drums. That's wild. I thought it was just like crates of like bottles.
Yeah. So it's like a really sophisticated like system. Like it takes a lot of engineering.
A pulley system? So there'd be some poor schmuck hauling on a rope for like 10 hours.
Or maybe horses going around in a circle.
They had motors.
With ginger up their ass. So,
Exactly. It could have been motorized.
Oh yeah, that's true. It was in the '20s. They had
That's
steam.
We have a town just on the other side of Windsor, just in case you're unfamiliar.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, it's called Detroit. It's a pretty big city. and real twist here, by the way, it's north of Windsor. What we didn't know about American.
That's weird geography.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a short river. It's not a big.
Yeah. It's amazing. I think the thing was, is that because, you know, like they, like in this kind of like system of supply and demand, a lot of Canadians and Americans saw there was a serious demand and a lack of supply. And it was kind of like they were the kind of tech startups of their age, I guess. They were just thinking outside the box to see how they could feed their demands.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So farming and fishing wages were like $35 a month at the time. And in that kind of border area, you could easily earn $400 a month from if you were a captain of a ship that was smuggling, because the booze sold from their cargoes would be $200,000 or more per kind of cargo that was taken across, which is crazy.
And you're not even breaking laws in your own country. Like, what are they doing?
No.
It's not that serious either. It's not like we're going to keep you against extradition. Like, all right, go back home. Yeah,
exactly. But then also like the Canadian Customs and Excise Department was being pressurized by the US government, but they were really small. You know, the border wasn't really much of an issue until this point. Right. And also they were more than welcome to take bribes and were seen seriously corrupt.
Oh, of course.
And both sides of the border as well, I think.
Are you familiar with, and this might be more specific to the US experience, but are you familiar with the 12 and 3 mile limits?
No.
So when they first put the Volstead Act together, it was extended in a 3 mile limit around the contiguous US. The law that made prohibition law, the Volstead Act. The Volstead. So you had a 3 mile circle around the United States beyond which prohibition didn't exist. If you ever stood on the beach, you can see like 6 or 7 miles. So you could see outside of the, you know, where it was illegal. So all of these ships, these permanent floating ships, would just set up anchor, these gambling houses, just 3 miles out with high-speed skiffs, and they'd have big neon signs that say, come drink and gamble on the gambling boat, and they would run high-speed skiffs up to the boat to the beach to bring customers out.
That's amazing.
You could go out for take a to-go cocktail, buy it at 3 miles out, and enjoy it back on the beach when you get back home. Then they moved it out to 12 miles. Naturally, there was a 3 mile limit cocktail and also a 12 mile limit cocktail. The 12 mile limit is the better drink. The 3 mile limit is not much loved cocktail. But they moved out to 12 miles, which, you know, it was less visible, but everybody was still doing this. So I'm assuming also that a big portion of, and I do know this, is that there would just be like floating warehouses of alcohol sitting just offshore, just to be ferried in at the moment's notice. You know, they were just out there all the time. And then when Al Capone needed, or not Al Capone because he had his own supply system, but like when somebody needed, we need another couple hundred crates or whatever. Okay, just run a boat in tonight. There's no moon. So, I mean, it was extremely porous.
That's incredible. It's like a boozy 1920s Waterworld.
There's a lot of
we talk about Waterworld a lot in this show recently.
It's a good film.
It's underrated film. It was ahead of its time, and its time will come. You know, someday.
So that was the thing. Like, I think boats became a big part of this. So they were like fitting like fake chambers and false bottoms on there, and then they were just getting inventive as well. So they were hiding booze in like Bibles and children's toys and in like vegetables and things as well. And also on top of that kind of funnel system that we were talking about.
By the way, I just love that it's called the funnel. I'm just imagining the funnel. Some broke nose mob says, "Yeah, go down that funnel."
Exactly.
Send another couple barrels down the drain. What drain? The funnel. You know.
And also we had boat houses either side of the river. They would have secret tunnels underneath as well.
Tunnels still exist?
I'm sure there's probably some. I wouldn't go in them. I don't think they've been maintained, but
right. I've actually probably a lot of them have been, to be honest.
Yeah, maybe they are.
There's huge network of tunnels underneath Boston that's held over from the Revolutionary War, and it got a lot of use both during fugitive slave, you know, during the what do you call the
Oh, the Underground Railroad.
Thank you. Yes. During slavery, as a way to hide slaves running from the South. And also got a lot of use again during Prohibition. Right. Every few decades, Boston's like, all right, time to dust off the tunnels. You know, to find a new use here for these guys.
Was it your Boston accent?
No, it was a terrible Boston. It was Boston my way, the Upper East Side. I don't have a Boston accent.
I think maybe they're just like, it's like lots of legal Canadian weed is coming through, but I mean, it's legal in lots of states in America.
We just legalized it in New Jersey. Yeah.
Oh, you did? Yeah, exactly. Oh, wow. Joe, my hair absolutely stinks. I've been doing a location scout for a shoot I'm doing in a cannabis factory nearby, and I was there for an hour and a half, and my clothes absolutely stink. I was in the flower room taking some photos and making notes ready for the shoot, and my whole body just smells of it. It's crazy.
Oh my God. Shouldn't have told your wife where you were going. Should have just.
I know. Did you have a good day? Like, right. Anyway,
I just unaware that your day job was with High Times. I had no idea.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, exactly. So, 75% of all the illegal liquor brought into the United States was from the Detroit River from Canada.
Wow, it's like all of it. 75% is a lot. That's a lot.
And a lot of Americans would cross over the border for a good time.
For sure.
And they go, so they'd have a lot of roadhouses. There was a place called the Island View Hotel just off the Detroit River with its own dock. It got quite interesting in the winter as well when the river froze. They used to drive these light cars that were six cylinder engines called whiskey sixes, and they would just drive them across the ice full of booze to deliver them at night. And then they started using aeroplanes as well.
For sure.
And also railways. They would using railways to take 800 cases of beer every day, apparently.
Jeez.
So there was a really effective Navy, Air Force, and kind of land army of people running booze in and across.
My question is, like, if there was really no legal ramifications for getting caught, why all the underground sneaky shit? Why not just like, here he goes, yep, you can't stop us, here's the booze. Like,
I think like people, there were like cases of people going to prison and busted and things. Yeah. I think it's like, you know, like cannabis has been, or a lot of like mild recreational drugs. Some people turn a blind eye, some people don't. I think like it was very much, I think it depends how well connected you were and what your socioeconomic position was on whether you really paid the price for getting drunk, I guess.
I also think too, there's a big difference between you finding like, you know, a fifth of gin in somebody's hip flask and finding 800 crates, you know, barrels of whiskey in their boat. Like,
exactly.
I want to look the other way, but you're making it real hard. Yeah,
exactly. Or a secret tunnel. Is this your secret tunnel?
Yeah, exactly. Like,
it's a school project.
Now, you said that you said that there was 75% of all liquor brought into the U.S. came by way of the Detroit River, but that's not accounting for all illicit. That's not including, you know, everything that we were making ourselves here.
Right. No. I think 75% came from Canada, mainly across the Detroit River, because obviously you had like most of Canada's like population and industrial area was just over the border there.
For sure.
And I think the rest came from the Caribbean. But that doesn't include everything that was being brewed at home in bathtubs and everything else.
Right. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Gotcha.
Gin. Right.
I think, what was it? They were looking at this. So there were between 16,000 and 25,000 speakeasies and clubs in the Windsor, Detroit area.
Amazing.
Wow. And the popular drinks of the time depended on the club. Like, sure. They would distinguish themselves by the drink they offered. So you would go to a club depending on what you could get there. And the criminal gangs either owned or provided protection to the clubs from other gangs and the police. And they used to say, Joe sent me was the phrase used to gain entry to a speakeasy.
What?
All speakeasies?
No, just in that area, it was a trend where they would say speakeasy.
In the Detroit area. Okay.
Joe sent me was the kind of, although it's quite easy, you know, I think once you should probably change your secret password on a regular basis. Like,
yeah.
Like, right, like yeah. Your Gmail. Like,
it's like, yeah. It's probably a joke. I bet I knew this at one time and I don't anymore. If I had guessed, there's probably their ward boss that everybody nicknamed Joe, who was notoriously corrupt, or I'm just guessing, but or something to that effect.
Yeah. Probably, yeah. Probably, yeah. It's got like an origin story.
Oh, that. It certainly does. Yeah.
And another name for a speakeasy was a blind pig.
Blind pig, or I've also heard blind tigers as well. Yep.
That's why? Cool.
I don't know.
It's great. like a lot of slang, if kind of someone comes up with it one day with no real explanation about where it came from.
So rot gut, Huska is a prison. It's a couple of other names too, but yeah, blind pig, blind tigers. I've heard both of those.
Okay. And everybody knows Al Capone. He's kind of like a legend now, but
sure.
Canada had his own version of Al Capone.
What?
Beer Baron.
And his name was King Canada, and which is subtle.
yeah. Yes.
His real name was Blaise Diesberg. Now, Greg, I get slated all the time for my French pronunciation. I think that's Blaise Diesberg. That might not even be French.
Yeah, anyway. I was going to say, by the way, I mean, this guy's living, you know, he's living just across from Chicago. I don't think his French pronunciation was going to be on the money either, man.
That's okay. So I'm just going to call him Blaise
Diesberg over here.
Exactly. Exactly. So he was a major figure, and he was in direct contact with Al Capone, and they used to do deals together. He used to supply him on a regular basis. And
King Canada. Did he name himself? Did other people like...
Yeah, that's a good question.
Right. I don't know if it's like I'm a mob boss. I probably need a cool name. It's like a Batman villain. You got to come up with a good name.
You do.
So it does sound like one of the B-list Batman villains.
It's like the worst name you could ever give your King Canada. It's like some kind of weird failed superhero, man. It's he had a cape like.
I don't know. I hope he did. But he used to send a plane to Al Capone full of booze directly.
Wow.
Hang on. I just caught up on my own notes. So King Canada was an alias to hide from legal authorities. But
the law didn't know he was Blaise Diesberg.
Yeah, yeah.
They just knew him as King Canada.
It was the 1920s Canadian Heisenberg.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So,
I get this reference.
Yay! He would stockpile a load of whiskey and beer, which he called plants for some reason, underground to hide them. And he would put them in like cisterns underneath the ground.
Gotcha.
So he would fly planes to remote areas and would like rent a field from a farmer and just bury a load of... booze underground, and then Capone's or the other mob bosses, people would know which field it was and
go
and then risk it. Yeah, exactly. So he would be using the fields as like an airfield as well as a storage facility that was, you know, almost impossible for anyone to find.
Wow. That's how it worked out.
Yeah, it's a really cool system.
How did he retire?
We'll get there.
Okay. I'm always curious because, like, you know, you hear about the smart mobsters. You want to know what was their exit strategy, because a lot of the famous ones didn't have one. They died.
Right. No, exactly. It was a slightly more romantic way to go if you kind of he retired comfortably.
He puts the polish on it for me personally.
he made a huge amount of money with his kind of flying in his stockpiled planes. And he actually came face to face with Al Capone at one point, and was determined to make it clear to Capone that he wasn't afraid of him. And apparently the quote is, he said, "Listen, I am King Canada, and you know you can't fool around with me. I know every move in Chicago, every move you make. I am King Canada. Respect me."
I'm also now imagining Capone stifling a laughter at hearing Chicago.
Did he actually say Chicago?
No, that was me.
No,
that was
no. Me. I was overtying that. That's a fact now.
I wish he should. He pronounced it Chicago and everyone Chicago,
damn it. I meant
back.
Chicago. Now I look like an asshole. Nobody's going to take King Canada seriously now. Crap.
I brought my rebrand. Cape and everything. Fuck.
I'm going to rebrand as Duke Canada instead. And apparently he insisted that Capone was a good guy. And that he was actually, there was like he had a lot of respect for him. And it also, as he also he said to him, what do you think I am? Don't you think I know something through the government of what's going on in Chicago? So he was basically just like,
it's called Chicago.
Chicago. I don't know why he was kind of like felt like he had to put like an alpha personality like to threaten Capone. Yeah. I mean, they were doing a lot of business together.
Yeah, maybe Capone had been muscling in on him. You know, one of the things that you said that, like, he said that Capone was a good guy. I'm sure Capone wasn't a good guy, but there's another side of that coin. But I bet the truth is somewhere in between because, like, you know, you don't – yeah, being, like, a sociopathic monster definitely helps. But at the same time, like, people have to be able to do business with you. They have to, like – right. Capone's word has to be worth something. Like, he has to show up with the money and the product when he says – you know what I mean? Like, can't be like every deal with Capone ends in a widespread homicide, you know?
You're right. Exactly.
Nobody would do business with the guy. It would be impossible.
Exactly. So King Canada was actually using old bomber planes as well that could hold 25 cases of whiskey. So
and they're really old bomber planes. Before World War II. Yeah.
Exactly. World War I bomber planes where you could like walk across the wings. Yeah. Right, I imagine.
So, why didn't he have a Zeppelin? Oh, Jesus.
Oh my God. King Canada totally needed a cape and a Zeppelin. Can you picture? Yeah.
On the top going, you can't catch me, Batman.
Yeah. Yeah, the Zeppelin coming across the border, King Canada standing on top, his cape waving in the wind. You know, I'm not afraid of you, Capone, and all of you Chicagoans.
Just a kid goes, it's Chicago. Damn. Anyway. But he actually, he lived until the 80s. I know he didn't go, like, I think Capone is a legend because he obviously died kind of more exciting circumstances, but
syphilis. It's very exciting.
Yeah, exactly. As was the tradition of the day.
As was.
Holy hell. It's time for a special announcement.
He lived till 1989 and retired in his hometown of Bell River. And is celebrated by the town. There's like history walks. The old Prohibition buildings and secret passages might be turned into museums one day for anyone interested in the history of Prohibition. We should all go there after COVID.
After COVID.
King Canada was celebrated, like revered, for selling booze illegally to Al Capone.
I don't think
it doesn't like, he's like our hero, King Canada, the booze smuggler. Well,
I guess he didn't break any laws in Canada. He was just selling alcohol.
That's true. That's so, probably right. Also, I bet that he, you know, if he was breaking them laws, I bet he took real good care of the locals.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. He was probably very popular with
chicken in every pot in that neighborhood, I bet.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, I never even thought of that. That's a good point, right?
But one of my favorite things that I found, and we talked about this earlier, so you suggested about the floating warehouses.
Yeah.
So there was a prominent rum-running vessel called the Malahat, which was a 5-masted schooner that was used to transport lumber around... it was based in Victoria in BC in 1917 and was more of a used for industrial kind of shipping of supplies across the coast, and was then brought into service in World War I. So it was a pretty large ship, pretty serious ship.
I mean, that's a schooner, it's no joke. What was it called? The Malahat?
The Malahat, M-A-L-H-A-T. So it was a 5-masted schooner. And it had engines fitted, and in 1920 it became a rum-running vessel. What? It was 246 feet and had an average speed of 5 knots and could carry 100,000 cases of Canadian alcohol in a single voyage. Jeez. And it became known as the Floating Warehouse or the Queen of Rum Row. And she would sail up and down the Pacific coast for literally... consistently for 13 years delivering alcohol across the American coast, and also sailing all the way to Hawaii as well.
Wow.
And it's people say it's like a mystery that it stayed in service for so long. But they said the reason it didn't get caught was the captain's sister would receive radio transmissions from coastal vessels trying to pinpoint where it was or where the Coast Guard was. So they had this kind of spy network that was essentially letting know the movements of official government kind of vessels.
And then
when Prohibition ended in 1933, it went back to shipping wood, which I imagine was less fun.
Right. Yes. Yes.
So there was a network of people who would, like, they knew that the ship was on its route, and they wanted to help just because booze. And so they'd like, oh, that's so fucking cool. Oh my God.
So essentially you have this network of people who wanted to get hammered. They wanted a good weekend.
Yeah.
So they're like, well, of course I'm going to help out. I want the booze to arrive. So, yeah. and it was, you know, there was like the big shipping kind of vehicle of his day. So when she actually was in service until 1944, until it eventually sank in the Powell River. But incredible, though. It was, again, a bit like Waterworld, but
it's a real world.
Exactly. Well, everything gets back to Waterworld. But it kind of is an incredible kind of like idea of like how serious this was. The fact you had this giant kind of ship that was like served in World War I and that was just went back to his old job, old boring job afterwards is
246 feet long, 43 foot beam. This is a big boat.
Jeez. It's crazy. And also you need like a really experienced crew as well.
Oh, yeah.
A competent captain to sail from Vancouver or Victoria all the way over to Hawaii is pretty impressive.
Yeah. You think about the overhead costs of running something like that, you know.
Exactly.
No, and how would they pick it up? Like, would they just come in little skiffs in the cover of darkness to come and get their...
Maybe they would go into those offshore kind of party boats and just offload in there. I don't know. I guess...
The easy work.
Which is amazing. But then the party ended, or started again, depending on how you look at it. In 1933, Congress passed the 21st Amendment and repealed the 18th Amendment.
Huzzah!
And the rum runners... who were making big money, their lucrative business died overnight, and essentially they had to go back to being farmers and fishermen and cutting down trees. And party was over for them, yeah. And that was the end of it. So the brief boom of 13 years of illicit alcohol running was over.
Good fellas, no more. Now I gotta wait like everybody else.
Prohibition. So was it illegal to sell it or to have it?
To produce it, to
sell, to transport, produce, I think is what it was.
But you could get alcohol for medicinal purposes.
You could get a prescription for medicinal booze. No, I'm not kidding at all. And there was a few of our sort of storied distilleries survived Prohibition by producing medicinal alcohol throughout. Under a government contract. It was like some distilleries.
What were they prescribing booze for?
Nerve medicine.
Ah, right. Yeah.
It's the same. I mean, it's the same bullshit that we had medicinal weed for. I mean,
right.
Yeah. Anything.
That's true. Yeah. No, I was thinking like if it's not illegal to own it, if it's legal to produce it, to transport it and to sell it, there, I'm sure there must've been guys who've tried to figure out ways around that. Like, okay, we've got all this booze in this establishment. We just own it. We didn't make it and we're not going to sell it to you, but we will charge you a $20 an hour fee for sitting here and just give you as much as you want or something like that. Like, we're not selling you booze. We're selling you the time on your table or whatever. Like, you know, I don't know.
So
I think they would have seen through that.
No, they didn't. I mean, well, so you have to understand that the places that were doing this were never going to come under the purview of the law anyway, because these were your very, very sort of, you know, pillars of the community, gentry kind of establishments. This is the very the upper class. So like one of the most famous cocktails of all time is the Last Word, which is a equal parts mix of maraschino liqueur, gin, lime juice, and gin, maraschino, lime juice. Oh, and chartreuse.
Did you say that off the top of your head? Is that
It's a cocktail I make all the time. I'm embarrassed that it took me that long to remember the chartreuse. But it was invented at the Detroit Athletic Club during Prohibition, where the Detroit Athletic Club was a private club that had a pre-Prohibition stockpile of alcohol for the enjoyment of its members. And so that's, you know, but I mean, this is like where like J. Pierpont Morgan would pull in for a drink and stuff like that. Like nobody's arresting these guys, right?
Right. But they're not selling it though.
They weren't selling it. No, it was for the enjoyment of the members. But you know, right. I mean, what does membership cost at a place like that? Who knows?
Right. Yeah. Well, fascinating.
And like specifically J. Pierpont Morgan, I think that's who it was. There's like some legend that like the day like before Prohibition went down, he bought like some 10,000 cases of champagne so that he would not run out. And he didn't.
You know? Attaboy. That's amazing.
No, I think the Prohibition probably like pushed more people to drink than had it not happened is my guess, right? You tell someone they're not allowed to do something, they want to do it more, right? That's just
there's two schools of thought on that. If we look at the numbers, people definitely drank less after Prohibition than they did before it. But there was also new forms of entertainment available too.
See, there's totally different like schools of thought. One is the facts that you're mentioning, and the other is my uneducated opinion.
Oh no!
Everything no. Jesse knows is based on things he's read in public toilets written. Yeah,
not at all. I mean, by the end of I think that Prohibition was initially somewhat effective but brutal and nightmarish, and then by its end, it was not really effective at all. Is kind of what happened. That like drinking was kind of, you know, we didn't. Ultimately, yes, the people who really were pushing for prohibition in the U.S., they hated alcohol. But the people who passed the laws didn't care about it at all. The reason that they finally got the amendment through was because the real hardcore temperance movements didn't care who they got into bed with to get it done. And they ended up getting hooked up with a nativist movement. And so they got – once they started associating alcohol consumption in bars with being either German or Italian – or Irish, God forbid, all of a sudden it became very popular to outlaw that shit.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, wow. It was very much an anti-immigration thing.
No way.
Yep.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Wow.
Do I find crazy, though, as well? I'm looking at this now. Although they outlawed booze, mm-hmm. there was so much other stuff that was legal. So cocaine.
Oh, super legal. Cocaine is everywhere.
Because it was in...
It's in Coca-Cola.
It was illegal in the original Coca-Cola. Yeah.
Yeah.
Crack was fine. You could have no alcohol, but crack.
I didn't know crack was legal. Like,
oh, no. Sorry. I misread. Heroin. Skip over that. Heroin. Sorry. Heroin was fine.
The company Bayer that makes aspirin, like Bayer's aspirin.
Yes.
They invented heroin.
They invented heroin and they tested it on slaves in concentration camps during World War II. Yeah, it's a Nazi company.
I did not know that. Yeah. Oh my God.
This is the podcast I want to start. It's called Guess Who Else Was a Fucking Nazi?
I would listen to that show.
Also, amphetamines were fine.
Amphetamines for sure, yeah.
You could buy them over the counter.
Little inhalers of them. That's right.
Yeah, inhalers. And they were used in World War II to keep soldiers awake.
Absolutely.
And also, they were called pep pills, and they were given to students studying.
Yeah.
What?
Cocaine was used for headaches. It was a headache medicine.
That's great. I love that.
Yeah, you get some headache powder. Exaggerating. It was fucking everywhere. My favorite thing about Coca-Cola, it was invented by this guy, Dr. Pemberton, who, and this is... It ties right back into Prohibition. There was a popular, kind of wine called Vin Mariana, which was a Bordeaux with a lot of cocaine jammed into it. And Dr. Pemberton thought that it was a really good health tonic if it wasn't alcoholic, because alcohol, as we know, is really bad for you. It's the tool of the devil. So he wanted to invent a non-alcoholic version of Vin Marianne, so that he could have his booze cocaine without the booze. That was the function of it. Yeah. I love that.
And also marijuana became an alternative as well, according to this.
I don't doubt that.
So it was an attractive alternative and led to an increase of the use of the drug. Tea pads, where a person could purchase marijuana for 25 cents or less, began appearing in cities across the United States. There were plenty of alternatives.
Amazing. Yeah. So all of these incredibly dangerous illicit drugs were legal, and booze probably was outlawed due to anti-immigration, essentially. Is this?
Yeah. I mean, there was real... Like the saloon of the 1800s was a nightmare place. It really was like a.
I mean, how they show it in the movies is kind of exactly how
No, I would say honestly, it undersells it.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I mean, especially when you start talking about like in New York City, like where like McGurk's Suicide Hall, which was a very huge and famous saloon, McGurk's Suicide Hall, where the proprietor's personal guarantee was some night this week someone's gonna die in here, and you better be here to see it.
Oh my god!
Yeah.
I mean, the Suicide Hall is. I mean, that sounds like a warm, cuddly name. I'm surprised.
Yeah, it got that name. It got the name because a disgruntled sex worker came in and drank sulfuric acid in the middle of the room one night to kill herself.
Oh my god!
It became known. It became McGurk's Suicide Hall, and it became a destination for people to kill themselves. And McGurk was happy to capitalize on that and advertise it as a great place to do so. Provide entertainment. Come on down. Kill yourself. We'll all have a good time.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was huge. It was huge. It wasn't like a little room. I mean, like 1500 people could drink in this like establishment at a time. It was absolutely massive, huge, like Grecian style, like columns holding up this like, you know, Victorian it's very strange thing. But one of the things I love about what happened with Prohibition is that all of these saloons were men only. The only people who were allowed to go in were men and sex workers.
Weird.
And often only white men, right? They were also always segregated. And so this moral majority who was afraid of the immigration and loose morals and all that stuff, they're the people who pushed through Prohibition. And what happens? Well, now instead of saloons, you have speakeasies, and they're completely outside the purview of the law. And so speakeasies are, by their very nature, all races and all genders welcome. They don't give a shit about the law. They want to sell alcohol. And so what actually ended up happening during Prohibition is that there's this enormous intermingling of sexes and races in a way that there never had been in America before. And then if you look at the tail end of Prohibition throughout the 30s, yes, of course, we have the Great Depression, and that might be a factor. But one of the factors from the 30s until probably like basically the end of World War II, there was very powerful leftist political movements here in the US, right? And I think a big part of that had to do with the fact that like all these people were meeting each other in saloons for the first time. I always forget who he married, but who's that composer? Okay, so I have a problem with names. I'm going to remember his name. Cole Porter. Cole Porter married an heiress. This is a true story. When he was a penniless musician who had no prospects at all, she just happened to fall in love with him because she met him in a saloon, in a speakeasy. And like is a true story, and it never would have happened otherwise.
They never would have crossed paths otherwise.
They never would have crossed paths. He would have died a destitute, broke piano player in McGurk Suicide Hall.
I love the idea that everyone got hammered together and it started a new social movement in a country because they'd all been drunk. They'd all like fallen out of the speakeasy. Gone looking for something to eat together. It's great. That's the best way to break down barriers.
I think it was hammered. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's all because of King Canada.
All because of King Canada.
Right, right. Because of King Canada.
As FDR said when he got elected, what America needs now is a drink.
Exactly. So as Joe Biden said, America needs a nap, I think. The last 4 years.
Yeah. I'll take a nap.
I'll take a nap. I think the world needs a nap, I think.
After 4 years of living under extreme stress, when it releases you, it's like, oh shit, I didn't even realize I had a broken back. I had no idea. You fixed it. Oh my God. That lasts about 4 hours. I'm back to feeling.
I think as well, like the crazy stuff as well with all the different other substances, like they weren't even on the horizon. Like the fact that alcohol was the main thing everyone was concerned about. And then like there was this creeping giant of all these other substances that people were high on. I just got this image of like a prohibition kind of, person out there like knocking doors and getting people to sign the petition to ban all alcohol. Meanwhile, they're like just taking pet pills and snorting cocaine to just make sure they can do five more doors before they go to bed. Unaware of the irony.
Right. No, it's absolutely true. It's 100%. You know, and then we talk about that too. Is like you mentioned that marijuana was legal at the time. And the only reason it became illegal is because it was popular amongst black jazz musicians and Spanish and Mexican immigrants. And once it got tied to that stuff, then they're like, we got to outlaw this. But if you like like listen to jazz from the 30s, like all normal people do. But a lot of it is about jazz, is about weed. There's just like a ton of music written about smoking reefer back in the 30s. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Oh my God, that's amazing. I didn't know. I loved jazz.
Bangers. I'll send you a podcast. I'll send you a couple of playlists on Spotify when we get
please.
Off.
Yes, yes, please.
It's amazing.
Yeah. One of my favorite.
Now we've got a reason to listen to 1930s jazz.
Beyond the fact that trad jazz is great, but you'll hear the expression "if you use a viper" or referring to vipers. A viper is a slang, comes from the hissing sound of sucking on a joint. So if somebody called themselves a viper, or to say that a place is a den of vipers, it was filled with weed smokers.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
Greg, you are a substances historian. That's what
I try to be. A substances historian. I like that. That's a compliment undeserved. Honestly, all I do is read other people's research. I can't call myself a historian.
That should be the name of your podcast, The Substances Historian.
No, because then I'm such a square, and then it would be like I'd have to be doing a lot of drugs on this podcast, and I can't. I'm just this week
I'm going to try. Or you could go to Portugal. Everything's legal there. So
yeah, but you don't get it. I'm a square. Like I'm genuinely terrified of a lot of those things.
Yeah, especially because like you don't know where he's come from or has been mixed with.
People are always very like, oh, but don't you want to have altered experiences and expand your mind? I'm like, no, I don't.
I want to watch reruns of The Office on Netflix. Thank you very much.
Power to you, but man, no.
Greg, where can people find your channel?
It's called How to Drink, and if it has a URL, but if you Google it, it'll be the first hit. How to Drink, it'll come up, and so yeah.
And you're on Twitch as well, yes?
I guess I am on Twitch. I should talk about that. I'm on Twitch. I'm probably going to have to hop over to Twitch right after I get off of this. Actually, I'm at twitch.tv/GregFromHTD. You know, unifying the brand there.
I'm going to sound square. I've never been on Twitch, so I don't quite know what it is. But.
Oh, it's a very okay. So it popped up about 5 years ago. It is the strangest phenomenon in the world. Okay. Where
it's UHF,
it's like UHF. Yeah, that's a great example. Yeah. It's people watch other people play video games, but more than that, they will pay you to watch you play video games.
Yes, they will.
It's a stout, and it's like when it first came out, I'm like, oh, this is a new fad. This isn't going to last at all. And it's just kept growing. I'm like, how is this a thing? I used to Twitch for fun, not professionally, just for shits and giggles. And I'm like, how is this a thing? How are people wanting to watch me play video games all the time? It's very strange.
Well, and it's not all. When I said it was UHF too, I mean, 80 or 90% of it is video games, but it's not all video games. Like I, when I'm on Twitch, a lot of times I'm just standing in my bar conversing with guests and making drinks and taking suggestions.
Oh yeah, no, that's true. Yeah.
That sounds more appealing to me though. That's kind of quite social.
There is a lot of more social stuff on there, and there's a lot of I love it because I get to just like talk to the fans like in real time.
Right.
God, oh, I hate that phrase just escaped my lips. The fans. I get to talk to the fans. Oh my God, what a pompous asshole.
You've got over 1 million subscribers. I think you have some fans. I think it's okay for you to own that. That's okay.
Yeah, I don't like to objectify them in that way. Like it's no, yeah. Like my public awaits. It's just
my other friend Reese, he once told me that his father was on Twitch, and his father was in his late 70s, I think.
It's amazing.
I'm like, what? He's on Twitch? And I went and checked him out. And yeah, he wouldn't play video games. He would literally just he was in a wheelchair, and he was a theater actor, I believe. And so just drink wine, get drunk, and recite poetry.
Oh my God. I want to watch this. This sounds really good.
He unfortunately passed away, but he had thousands of followers who like would send so much money to donate to him that he never asked for. They bought him a new mattress. They bought him.
Oh my God.
Oh yeah. Like they fell in love with him, and he'd just go on every night and just get drunk and eat food and pet his dog and just chat with everybody in the most eloquent sort of, he had this very amazing radio voice. Like it was an incredible story. I'm like, what? His father's just sitting and chats and gets drunk, and people loved it. So yeah.
Twitch is an amazing. Yeah, it's like UHF. There's all kinds of different shit.
Anything can happen on there. Yeah, it's just it's live. I think probably one of my most successful streams I ever did. I got a whetstone and I sharpened my kitchen knives for 3 hours. I just stood there, scraping the knife,
not saying anything, just staring unblinking.
No,
no.
No, I mean there was a lot of back and forth, but yeah, I mean it's just like. I don't know. Yeah. It's a weird, unpredictable, crazy thing. I don't know.
All right. Thanks so much for putting us in your ear holes just the way you like it. This has been another exciting episode of Canadian Politics is Boring. We've had Greg from How to Drink on here. Make sure to check out his channel, How to Drink, on YouTube, and also listen to his brand new podcasts coming out, The Substance Historian, as well as Guess Who the Fuck is a Nazi?
This was a blast, actually. This was a huge amount of fun. Thank you so much for having me, guys. When COVID's over, maybe we can do this in person at some time. It'd be really cool.
I'd love to.
Definitely.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And,
please.
And you know more about Prohibition than I did. And I did 10 minutes research and wrote some notes.
10 whole minutes? I didn't know that much.
More than he normally does. So
feel special. I was trying to impress you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, dear listener, do you enjoy listening to us ramble incoherently about Canadian politics and history? Boy, do we have a special fucking treat for you. We've got our first ever official live show at a bar.
It's at Two Crows Brewing on Brunswick Street in Halifax on Sunday, May the 26th at 8 p.m. And if you go to CanadianPoliticsIsBoring.com, if you look at the banner at the top, it will take you to the tickets so that you can book a ticket and come and spend some quality time. It is going to be a very intimate affair. There are like only about 50 tickets available.
It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to drink a lot. We're going to quiz. Reese is going to quiz me at the end, but he's also going to quiz the audience and see if they know more than I do. And any alcohol you buy, Reese and I, we promise to drink it, no matter how much it is. If you want to hold our hair while we barf in the plants outside of the bar, we'll do that for you.
So go to CanadianPoliticsIsBoring.com, click the banner at the top, and on Sunday, May the 26th, at Two Crows Brewing on Brunswick Street, we will see you there.